This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The United States sent about 120,000 Japanese Americans into internment camps during World War II. The camps reflected American fears in the wake of Pearl Harbor. It was a forced relocation that separated thousands of people from their homes and families. George Hoshida was one of those people. He lived in Hawaii with his Japanese-American family until he was arrested and sent to a number of internment camps across the country. His diary served as a tool to process and illustrate his time in the camps as he endured life apart from his wife and children. A new book, Taken from the Paradise Isle, is a collection of George's diaries and letters to his family. Editor Heidi Kim joins me now. She's an English professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome, Heidi. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Tell us about the Hoshida family and their life in Hawaii.
George and Tamai were both from plantation families, which was very common. A lot of Japanese had come in essentially as indentured labor for the sugarcane plantations. So he grew up cutting sugarcane. He had to drop out of school in order to go to work and help support the family. Tamai was from a similar family, and she also dropped out of school and trained to become a seamstress. They got married in 1933. They couldn't afford a honeymoon, so they just drove to the nearest beach. And they bought a small house. George got a job as a salesman for the electric company. They had three daughters, and things were looking pretty good for them until December 1941.
George was not a citizen, though he could have been, because he married, his wife was a citizen.
That's right. George came with his family when he was 4 years old. And at that time, Asians were not permitted to naturalize by the laws of the United States. So he wasn't able to become a citizen until those laws were changed after World War II.
But his wife, Tamai, was.
Yes, she was born in Hawaii.
All right. So tell us about his arrest. Well, tell us about the internment program that followed the attacks on Pearl Harbor.
So right after Pearl Harbor, several specific targets, a few hundred men, were on the list of the FBI, and they were arrested immediately. But the larger movement that we think of as the internment or incarceration, that happened a few months later. And so several hundred thousand people, we think about 120,000 in total, were taken from their homes, particularly along the West Coast, and selected people from Hawaii, and were put into camps that were hastily built in isolated parts of the country. Some were in California, and they went as far east as Arkansas.
And many of them were U.S. citizens.
Yes, over two-thirds of them were actually U.S. citizens of various ages.
And we use the word internment, I guess, because we don't like to think about imprisoning American citizens, but it was prison. They were sent. Their freedom was restricted. This is a prison sentence.
Yes, that's why the terminology has changed over the years. The Japanese American community has started to drift away from the term internment because it implies that foreignness, and that was a stigma that they struggled so hard against during the war.
Yeah, they were imprisoned. And George Hoshida, now, why was he on that list? He was targeted, right, as a potentially dangerous alien?
He was. He wasn't arrested right after Pearl Harbor. He was arrested in February of 1942. And from what I was able to learn, most of his involvement in activities that were considered stereotypically Japanese was what condemned him. So, for example, he was a very devout Buddhist, and he was extremely involved in his Buddhist church. He was also a very prominent member of the YBA, which is like the YMCA. It's the Young Buddhist Association. That's actually how he met his wife.
There are excerpts, the transcript, in fact, of George's hearing when he was arrested. What does that tell us about the way Japanese Americans were treated and viewed through this process?
That's a remarkable document. I was so lucky to find it in the National Archives. That shows us, it's a transcript of the actual hearing, so his dialogue with the board that was hastily convened, but it's also their conversations before he comes into the room and after he exits the room. And so what we learn from that is that they were heavily relying on informants, both in the Japanese American community and other people who felt that they had some knowledge of the Japanese American community. And so on the one hand, you have poor George Hoshida, who's trying to produce any evidence he can of what a great American he is. He's saying, I gave blood and I've donated to the Red Cross. But the informant is delivering their opinion, and that's really what the board relies on in the end.
And he is then separated from his family. His family was also sent to camp. So maybe we can talk about the Odyssey and where he went and where the rest of his family were sent.
Yes, it really was kind of an odyssey. And George tried to put the best possible face on it and say, well, I never would have had this opportunity to travel. But first he was sent to Oahu, to the camp near Honolulu called Sand Island. And then he was sent to the mainland. He passed through Angel Island in Oakland. Then they went to Texas, and they stayed there for quite a while. And then they went to Lordsburg, New Mexico. That's where he spent the longest time. They were then transferred briefly to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And finally, he was released to join his family at quite a late date.
And you say his family, but it was not all of his family, right? They had to leave a daughter behind.
Right. So directly after George's arrest in 1942, his wife, Tamai, found out that she was pregnant for the fourth time. And she nearly had a nervous breakdown at the very thought, because their oldest daughter was severely disabled. They'd been in a car accident when she was a toddler, and she was blind and deaf, and also had severe physical disabilities. So they had to put her in a home, and they had to leave her behind because there were no facilities to care for disabled people in the camps. So Tamai gave birth at the end of 1942, and about 2 months later was put on a boat with her three younger daughters to go to the mainland, and they were sent to a camp in Arkansas.
Why was George separated? How common was this, I guess, for families to be separated this way?
It actually wasn't that common. For the Hawaiian residents, it was more common because the Hawaiian incarceration happened very differently. Only about 1% of the Japanese American population from Hawaii was actually incarcerated. And that's partly because the military leadership there had different views about their loyalty. And it's also partly for pragmatic reasons, because Japanese Americans were a third of the labor force, and Hawaii was an important military territory that needed labor. So once these men were identified and arrested, about 2,000 total of these men and their families were eventually incarcerated. On the mainland, some men, as I said, were arrested right after Pearl Harbor, and so they went through the same kind of familial separation, but not nearly as lengthy as the Hawaiians.
We know a little bit about the story of the imprisonment of American citizens during World War II, but the intimacy of this story, told through diaries and illustrations, I think, gives us a view that maybe we hadn't had, or at least not much, of this kind of intimacy. Tell us about that and what you learned by going through his diary.
That kind of intimacy is what really drew me to the story when I found it in the archives. The diary is really unfiltered, and it gives us such an intimate look at his daily concerns. Little things like, I woke up today with a headache. And also the fun that he has when he sees snow for the first time, and frost. He's fascinated by that. Also, it's a pretty uncensored voice. And a lot of the accounts of camp that we have, especially the ones that were published a few decades after, were really quite censored for a mainstream readership. So, for example, George briefly loses heart, and he considers taking the offer that the government extends for people to repatriate, as it was called, and go back to Japan. They would be exchanged, essentially, for American prisoners of war. Now, bear in mind, George hadn't seen Japan since he was 4 years old. He has no memory of Japan whatsoever. But he's so disheartened, and he thinks there's no future for him in the United States. So he actually considers taking that offer. And that's not something that people would have wanted to talk about right after the war, because it might have been seen as proof of disloyalty.
Tell us, too, about the illustrations, because they're also included in this book.
The illustrations are really terrific. It's all George's art that he drew while he was in the camps to keep himself entertained and also to entertain other people. So there are some beautiful full-color illustrations, which are really great because we have almost no color photos of this era. So illustrations like his are the only way that we see history isn't just black and white. But my favorites are actually the really briefly done sketches, which are the closest thing that we have to casual snapshots. And they really capture quiet, secluded moments in the incarceration. My favorite is one that he did in Texas. The Hawaiians were suffering terribly from the heat, and they were confined in these tents that only got hotter and hotter during the day. And he drew one picture of a friend who's just lying on his army cot in his underwear, staring up at the ceiling of the tent. And it's such a bleak moment.
The illustrations are interesting for another reason, just because of George's education as an illustrator. He took remote classes from a school that another famous illustrator, or I should say more famous illustrator, was also a part of. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was the Federal School, as it was then known, now known as Art Instruction. And Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts, was another young man with stifled ambitions who took correspondence courses from them. So George, as I said, had to drop out of school to support his family, but he was so devoted to education and to reading and self-improvement. So while he was working on a large plantation, he was able to take these correspondence courses, and the plantation manager actually gave him some facilities to study at night because he really admired his dedication.
What do we know about George's treatment and his family's treatment at the various camps where they were settled?
It really varied. There was a lot of hostility. George talks in particular about one guard who was tremendously hostile when they first arrived. And he actually spoke to him and confronted him about this hostility. And the guard said, "My brother was killed at Pearl Harbor. And if you make a wrong move, I'm going to shoot you down." And George really tried to talk to him and said, "You know, I'm really sorry about your brother, and we're all suffering together because of this war. These men are ministers, they're school teachers, they haven't done anything wrong. Some of them are older, we're not used to this heat. Maybe you could go a little easy on them." And by making this personal connection, he was able to really create better conditions. And both he and his wife were really able to engage people in that way.
They were finally reunited, but alas, not the entire family.
That's right. So at the end of 1943, they were finally able to reunite in Arkansas. And it's such an affecting reunion because it's the first time that George is seeing his youngest daughter. And of course, he hasn't seen his two middle daughters since the beginning of 1942. But unfortunately, they never saw their eldest daughter again because she was left behind in the nursing home and was drowned in the bath due to a nurse's negligence. And so they received that word at the very end of the war before they returned to Hawaii.
What happened to them after, when they were reunited and the war was over? What do we know about their lives after that?
They went back to Hawaii, as they had always planned. And, of course, they faced tremendous economic hardship. They'd lost their house. They'd sold all their possessions at a great loss. And so they really didn't know how to rebuild. They were living with relatives. They were slowly getting on their feet. And then they were knocked off them again by the great tsunami of April 1946 that hit Hilo. It's very famous there, and residents still remember that history. So then they had to rebuild all over again. And they did manage to do quite well. They actually moved to Los Angeles for a while in the 70s, and their three daughters grew up to become professionals. Two became nurses and one became a lawyer, and George was tremendously proud of them.
One of his nieces actually got sent to the West Coast, from the West Coast to the East Coast, to avoid the imprisonment. Tell us about that.
That's a fascinating story. She was at Pomona College, and fortunately, the president of the college was very foresighted and saw that the orders were coming down for general incarceration. So that president struck a deal with the president of Oberlin College, and the students were almost literally woken up in the dead of night, told to pack, thrown on a train, and gotten out of California only 2 days before the general order came down.
What was that climate surrounding Japanese Americans at UNC at the time?
So interestingly, what I was able to discover in a big research project I've been conducting with my students is that UNC became one of the places that tried to host Japanese American students. The climate here, I think, in some ways benefited from ignorance. There weren't that many Japanese Americans around, and so hostility hadn't built up. The language that my students found in the Daily Tar Heel, for example, at that time, is surprisingly moderate. when it speaks of Japanese Americans, although, of course, there's a lot of angry language against Japanese. But it seemed that they were able to make that kind of differentiation.
What do your students know about this? When you teach this, how much do they know about the internment to begin with? And what do they make of this story when you teach it in class?
Most of my students know extremely little about it. And they've taken the course because they say they always thought it was peculiar. It was maybe one line in their AP history textbook. And they just wanted to know more about it because it struck them as such an exceptional thing.
It was indeed. And in fact, I mean, even Justice Scalia has said that what we did then was wrong. I mean, even Justice Scalia thinks that that was a wrong thing to do.
Yes, it's something that gets regularly asked about now in Supreme Court justice hearings. And all of them concur that it was wrong and that the Supreme Court decisions that upheld it, even during the war, were wrong.
Interesting to see, though, and you've taught this in your class, you use this very recent comment by a mayor in Virginia who, talking about keeping Syrian refugees out, and he's very much in favor of closing the door on Syrian war refugees, said, of course we should keep them out. After all, we put the Japanese Americans in jail to protect ourselves from World War II. We should very definitely do this, as though he thought what we were doing was right. What happens when you teach that? And when I know that you've shown that message in class.
Yes, this was just last week. And so because we'd been discussing these issues, I actually just showed my students his press release and I let them do their own close reading of it. I stood back and let them apply what they'd learned. And so they really focused on, first of all, the language that he used. He used the verb sequester, which they found a very interesting euphemism. And also on the fact that he invoked President Roosevelt, of course, as the authority who had done this previously, but he skipped over the decades and decades of history that we've had in which presidents and congressmen of both political parties have worked to apologize for this and redress the damages that were done.
How typical of the experience do you think was George Yoshida and his family? I mean, it's one thing to get this beautiful, intimate portrait, but then the ultimate question is, well, is it typical of the experience of other Japanese interns at the time?
I think that people have grown to be careful of characterizing something as typical just because there were so many people and we try to really respect the individual experiences. That being said, I think that the extraordinary resilience and patience that they show actually is something that I have seen and admired in the community as a whole. When you look at other documents or when you hear other people's family stories, you really learn to admire the courage that these people displayed.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us today. UNC English professor Heidi Kim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Heidi Kim edited the new book, Taken from the Paradise Isle. It's about a family struggle in Japanese-American internment camps. Just ahead, we'll talk with a physical therapist who worked with war-wounded veterans at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and that will happen on The State of Things. You can join us in a moment if you please stay tuned.